The following program is an all-language show which includes open discussions on topics related to the LGBTQ plus community and beyond, including, but not limited to mature subject matter such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
Hi, I'm Saida Garrett, co-writer of Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mr. Mark Tara.
Today on Rainbow Country, Canada's queer and trans therapist directory. That and more next. So stay tuned. The Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, this is Emily Saliers from Indigo Girls.
Hey everyone, this is Chris Harder, porn star, burlesque performer, and the creator of Porn to Be a Star. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Well, hello, and welcome to a brand new journey through Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. And as always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. By the way, Rainbow Country originates from CIUT-FM in Toronto, and now proudly in syndication across Canada. Well, thanks to you tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately listening. Together, we continue to build Rainbow Country into a nationally syndicated gay radio show, as well as being a number one LGBT podcast. So, today, a spotlight on Canada's queer and trans therapist directory that was started by clinical social worker, psychotherapist, public speaker, and writer Raheem Thower, who joins me to talk about this new directory and so much more. Plus, in hour two, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. All that lies ahead as we start this journey through Rainbow Country. But our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, award-winning journalist and author Rhea Rollman reads from her 2023 Canadian history book, A Queer History of Newfoundland. By the way, on Amazon.ca, the book was a number one bestseller in local Canadian history.
High school teacher Anne Escott took her recess break that pivotal day in May 1974. It was a routine morning. Escott worked at Bishop's College, where she taught physical education and biology. Midway through the morning, she joined other teachers in the staff room for recess. The women preparing lunch for the students turned on the radio to a popular phone-in radio program that aired daily on CJON. None of this was unusual, but what Escott heard next caused her jaw to drop. The host of the program was interviewing a man named Norman Hay, who was a member of Gay Ottawa. Hay was visiting St. John's and had reached out to CJON offering to talk about his work with Gay Ottawa. They invited him in and put him on the air. When Escott tuned in, Hay was chatting about his work and said he was perplexed as to why he could find no sign of organized gay community in St. John's. "Where are all the Newfoundland gays?" he demanded in a tone of bemused frustration. Escott was floored. The visitor from the mainland was out and proud, a far cry from most Newfoundland queers at the time. Escott was a teacher. If she was outed as gay, she could be fired for it, thanks to clauses in her contract, colloquially referred to as morality clauses. So I was sitting there, sort of zombie-like, pretending not to pay attention, but actually paying very close attention, she explained to me. She remembers the broadcast quite vividly. I thought he was incredibly brave, because some of the people phoning in were just horrible. Others were quite supportive. I was just elated. I couldn't believe someone was actually doing this. As soon as she could, Escott slipped off to find a telephone. She phoned her girlfriend at the time, Sandy Pottle. I said, there's someone on the radio and they want to get a group together. Has anybody gotten his information? This was long before the internet, but the informal queer phone tree was already in operation. Pottle replied that another friend had just reached out and gotten his contact info. Apparently, at least a dozen gay people had phoned CJON looking for his contacts. There was going to be a meeting with him the following night. It was so wonderful, recalled Escott, of the day she heard Hay on the radio. It's hard to explain. It was wonderful, but terrifying. It was a mix of emotions. It was like, oh my God, there are other people out there who are doing this and on the radio, and maybe we actually can do something and not be murdered or killed. That morning's program set off a powerful buzz in the city's still largely underground queer community. Those who heard it discussed the remarkable interview and decided that if mainlanders could get on the radio and openly ask, where are all the Newfoundland gays, it was time for the Newfoundland gays to get organized. Joey Shulman was born in St. John's and grew up there in the 1950s. He was living in Toronto when the bathhouse raids took place in 1981 and was present in one of the bathhouses that was raided. He was arrested. It was for him one of the moments which reminded him how quickly societal tolerance can shift. It was a lesson he'd initially gleaned from reading about Oscar Wilde, who one moment was celebrated by British society and the next shunned and imprisoned. Shulman's own experience in the bathhouse raids underscored a similar theme. We need to learn from our past, he says. No matter how uncomfortable we get as gay people, there are always people like Hitler, people like McCarthy in the 1950s US, people like the RCMP fruit machine, the bathhouse raids. The bathhouse raids happened at a time when we felt so liberated. We were out in downtown Toronto. We were living in entire apartment buildings downtown. We were fabulous. We were exploding. We were just like Mary Tyler Moore, throwing our hats in the air. And then suddenly the police just clamped down. It's important for younger people to know that this was a real attempt to stop us from finding and having and sharing love, Shulman said. And that shouldn't be allowed. People came out of that defiant. It was our Stonewall moment. We took to the streets and we won all those rights that ensued. The stigma faced by those diagnosed with HIV was immense. Trudy Parsons recalled one community around the bay that she visited with activists Yetman and Upward to put off a workshop on a weekend. As they set up their materials and locals started filtering in, Parsons detected a strange atmosphere in the room. They were acting weird. I didn't know what was going on. They wouldn't make eye contact with me. Usually people will nod at you or speak or stare at you because they're mad, but they looked like they were holding a lot of guilt and shame, and I couldn't figure out why. They weren't even sitting with each other. They were all sitting with their backs to each other or turned away. I was like, what the fuck is going on? Then a fisherman guy comes in, and he's in his gear, and he stomps on in, and I thought, oh, great, he's going to give me a hard time, because he came in all aggressive. So we changed the order of speaking, and I got up right away, and I said, there's something going on here. What is it? You guys look like you're in a lot of pain. Then this woman turns around to the guy in the fisherman clothing and says, are we going to tell her? And he goes, yep. Then he says, we're ashamed. And I was like, okay, well, we're here to talk about difficult things. That was my mantra. We can talk about difficult things. So they talked about a gentleman that had come home with AIDS and they had crucified him. They just crucified him. The whole town. I can't remember the stuff that they did, but it was shocking. Absolutely shocking. They just did everything that they could to make the rest of his life as uncomfortable as possible, like throwing rocks at his house in the middle of the night and all kinds of really weird, fucked up things. And they were embarrassed about that. They were very brave in telling it, though. I couldn't believe they were sitting there and telling it. They were so brave. And they were committed to never behaving that way again. Like they were big grown men crying to break their hearts over their shitty behavior. It was something else. And it was more than just HIV. It was about homophobia, and it was about a man being considered what they said was sissy. It was all of that, too.
In the 60s, before the internet, to find each other, queer people needed to actually get together in real space and real time. Since most places didn't tolerate our kind, depending on where you were, your options could be limited.
Large cities might have a few specialized commercial spaces, but in the absence of those, it was basically public washrooms, parks, or house parties. They all had their downsides. Commercial spaces required you to spend money, and that's one of the reasons why they were mostly for men. Even in places as big as Toronto, there was seldom more than one lesbian bar at a time. Lesbians earned about 60% of the male wage and probably had more dependents. The economy just wasn't there. The old adage was, gay men go to restaurants, lesbians hold potlucks. Washrooms and parks were also pretty much boys only and could be dangerous, plus parks in the Canadian winter, not so good. You could freeze your willy off. House parties, you needed to know somebody, or know somebody who knew somebody, and so on, and be invited. In terms of commercial life, Montreal had led the pack, developing a sin city reputation during Prohibition in the U.S. in the 1930s. And where there's sin, there's always a place for us. Toronto the Good and Vancouver took a bit longer, but in 1974, Toronto had enough anonymity and a critical mass to produce a small commercial scene. At first, it was mostly straight bars where we were tolerated in a corner as long as we behaved. Next came a few straight-owned venues that served gay clientele. By the mid-70s, a new class of gay entrepreneurs emerged and started to open up on Church Street where rents were cheaper. But not everybody lived in Toronto or Montreal. In smaller centers, where businesses couldn't meet community needs, the lesbian and gay liberation movement of the 70s came up with a new model. Defy economics and do it for ourselves. We might not have a lot of capital, but we did have free labor. For example, the Lesbian Organization of Toronto established a non-profit community center in a ramshackle old Victorian house in 1977. It held dances and brunches and drop-ins and provided meeting spaces and a coffee house and hosted a phone line for a whole generation of women. Loot, as it was known, was following a strategy already developed elsewhere. In Saskatoon, the Zodiac Friendship Society opened its community center in 1973. Edmonton and Calgary soon followed suit. HALO, the Homophile Association of London, Ontario, started in 1974, and the Halifax Gay Alliance for Equality first began running dances in the Turret in 76 and later turned that into a community center. By the end of the decade, there was a network of lesbian and gay groups providing community spaces in dozens of medium-sized centers across Canada, volunteer-run and community-controlled. This is Tim McCaskill, a gay liberation dinosaur from another planet and author of Queer Progress.
Up next, Canada's Queer and Trans Therapist Directory.
Hi, everybody. This is Gino Vanelli. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Raheem Fower, hi, how are you?
I am doing well, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you are more than welcome. I have to say, thank you for returning to Rainbow Country. We last spoke in, I believe it was 2021. Funny how time flies. Okay, so you are a clinical social worker. You are a psychotherapist, public speaker, a writer. You recently launched Canada's Queer and Trans Therapist Directory. Canada's Queer and Trans Therapist Directory. Let's start there and talk to me essentially about this directory and essentially what's at the heart of it. What's it all about?
Yeah. So Canada's Queer and Trans Therapist Directory, or CQTT for short, it came from what started as a listserv that was specific to Toronto, where queer and trans therapists would say, hey, I need resources for someone I'm working with, or I have somebody who has approached me, but I can't see them. Can someone else take them on? And I was moderating this mailing list for a while. And back in 2013 or so, I was working at a sexual health clinic in Toronto, and there were so many people who could pay for private therapy, but didn't know where to go, because what they wanted was somebody who was queer trans identified, someone who knew their experience, or who they wouldn't have to explain too much to. And so at the time, I created like this PDF document of therapists that, you know, I knew of. And then that list just kept growing. And I was maintaining that document for like 10 years. And so this past summer, I launched this online directory. It's like Psychology Today, but gay. So therapists anywhere can, like anywhere in Canada, can register, list themselves, and then any queer and trans people or anyone else that wants, is looking for a therapist, can go in and search for the things they're looking for.
So you launched this in the summer of 2025?
That's correct. Yes, just August 25th.
So you were just giving us essentially an overview of it, but was there a flashpoint? Was there a moment that led you to say, something you were just saying, like, you know, someone wanted specifically a queer or trans therapist. Was that the moment that sparked all of this?
You know, that is, I think, the roots or the seeds even from back in 2013. But the idea of creating this directory, I think, if I had to name a flashpoint, I think it would be in about 2023, when the conditions of the pandemic were easing up a bit, but everyone had moved to virtual practice. And, you know, therapy is regulated provincially, and it didn't make sense anymore necessarily to say, I can only meet with somebody in Ontario, or somebody in Ontario can't see somebody in Manitoba. And so with people taking their practice online and registering with multiple colleges across the country, it made sense to have, like, it doesn't make sense to have everything concentrated in Toronto. Our country is much bigger than that. And, you know, using like virtual therapy is normalized now. Like it's so common. And so I would say it was the late stages of that, the pandemic conditions that really made it seem like, you know what, a PDF document is not going to do it anymore.
So is this across Canada then? Like, can therapists from BC or Newfoundland or wherever, can they become part of this? And then if a patient is in another province, can they access various practitioners potentially? Or potentially, how does this work?
Yeah, so when a therapist or practitioner logs on or creates a profile, they can say where they're located and who their regulating body is. So they might say the Nova Scotia College of Social Workers. You know, this is who I have my license with. Typically, you find people who are in your own province. However, some people have listed themselves and said, I'm registered in Ontario, in Manitoba, and in BC, or I'm registered in BC and in Alberta. And they went and registered in multiple places during the pandemic to expand their reach. So typically, a patient would go in and look for someone that's regionally near them. But if they type in, let's say, Alberta, it's possible that somebody who lives in Ontario is also registered there and can see them. So it expands the possibilities quite a bit.
And is there a specific website for this?
Yes, it is queertranstherapists.com.
Queertranstherapists.com. And so are these sessions, are they virtual? Are they both virtual and in person? How does that aspect work?
Yeah, great question. So the therapists that create, when they create their profile, they can state whether they do in-person, online, or both. They can put in their location. They also will tell you like areas that they specialize in. You know, because lots of people want a queer therapist, but the thing they're working on is not necessarily about queer identity. right? It could be somebody struggling with an eating disorder, a body image issue, or substance use. And so the therapist will list the kinds of things that they specialize in or have expert knowledge in. And so the service user can kind of search using key terms to see who might be a good fit for them.
I did therapy for 10 years and my therapist was also gay. That doesn't necessarily mean, like you were just saying, that, you know, you're necessarily talking about, you know, like queer topics. And having a gay therapist doesn't necessarily mean that your therapist is necessarily a good therapist or not.
100%.
Thank goodness, like, my therapist was really good and, you know, did it for 10 years. How is there a vetting process for the therapists that are part of this?
That's a great question. So I don't have a way to vet people because provinces regulate people who can provide psychotherapy. But what I've asked is that people list who they're licensed with and additional certifications they have, additional trainings. And I've created a blog section that says how to select a psychotherapist. So it hopefully empowers the end user to ask the right questions to see if somebody is a good fit or not. If somebody is, you know, not a good fit, that happens. That's okay. But I leave it to existing regulating bodies to see, mm-hmm. you know, if somebody is like qualified or not.
And you're saying the word psychotherapist.
Yes.
Are they strictly psychotherapists or are they also like psychiatrists or what have you?
That's a great question. So the term psychotherapy is regulated, like the term itself, because it's a controlled act in certain provinces. So in Ontario...
So I don't mean to cut you off, but let's take a step back and psychotherapist. Talk to me about that practice specifically.
Yes. So being a psychotherapist usually would mean that you can identify a disorder or a problem that somebody is experiencing. You can't diagnose them, but you have a sense of the criteria and you're providing treatment or some kind of talk therapy intervention to reduce their symptoms and work on core issues.
And can they prescribe medications?
The average,
or is that strictly like just like a psychiatrist?
Yeah, it would be the people who can prescribe medication would be nurse practitioners or psychiatrists or anyone with a medical degree. So some psychiatrists and some doctors will practice psychotherapy, and they could be part of the list. But by and large, most therapists in our country are. They either have a master's in counseling psychology or they have a master's of social work. And so they're trained to support people through all kinds of problems, but they cannot prescribe medication.
Mm-hmm. And how's the reception been?
You know, it's been really good. People have been saying, you know, thank you for creating this. It's such a useful resource. I've always hoped there would be something like this. You know, by October 15th, we had 100 therapists sign up. So that's a huge milestone. I think we'll have to just wait and see how it takes off, you know, because it's a subscription-based service for therapists. And so they'll stay on if they get clients using this platform. So we're kind of going to have to give it at least 6 months, I think, to see fully what the response is like. But initially, it's been great.
And are there areas of the country where there's more pickup? Like, are there specific provinces where these therapists are coming in droves?
Yes. So Ontario is more represented than any other province. And that's expected because of the population density in Ontario, and also because that's my home province. And so that's where I've had the most networks and connections. But there's been a steady increase in folks from Quebec in folks from British Columbia, a couple of folks from Manitoba. So I think, you know, Alberta and the Atlantic provinces will take a bit more time for there to be an increase.
And why do you think that is? Any thoughts on that? Do you think it's like political in some sense or what?
Not so much. I think an email on its own is not enough outreach. And, you know, I think it's going to take some time for just the word to get out there, you know? And so as clients and service users start using the platform, therapists will also become aware of it. So I think it just takes a bit of time for it to flow through the country. And I personally don't have a lot of networks in Atlantic Canada, you know? And so it'll take some time to build those relationships and for people to start using it.
And on that note, we'll return after this Rainbow Country update.
Hi, I'm Agnes. My new record, Magic Still Exists, is out now. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Hi, I'm Jamie B. of TG CD Style Toronto, and I'm a professional feminization makeup artist and stylist providing male-to-female transformations and mentoring to those who identify as a cross-dresser or a trans woman. I first heard of Rainbow Country and Mark Tara in trying to find a radio station that specifically caters to the LGBT community, and I'm so grateful I found this station. It's crucial having a platform like Rainbow Country that welcomes all aspects of the queer community, including allies like myself and what I do. It casts a spotlight on specific needs and interests of human beings, ensuring that people from all walks of life are being validated. It's a real privilege to be able to work with cross-dressers and trans women by helping them align themselves with their feminine energy through the glorious feminization process. So, I want to thank Rainbow Country and Mark Tara for providing this platform for all of us.
So, as you may know, Rainbow Country is an award-winning gay radio show that's heard on broadcast radio, streaming, as well as a podcast. The broadcast outlets that carry Rainbow Country are listener supported. They rely on donations to help keep the lights on and the airwaves broadcasting. So if you think what I'm doing here on Rainbow Country is worthwhile, I hope you'll consider making a donation to this very outlet you are tuned to. If you happen to be listening to the podcast version of Rainbow Country, I hope you'll consider making a donation to an outlet that does carry this little gay show. How can you do that? Well, simple. Simply head over to marktara.ca, where everything is connected, and hit the donations banner. That's where you'll find all the outlets that broadcast Rainbow Country, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. Have your voice, have your support, especially for independent queer radio, heard.
I'm Billy Newton Davis, and we're sitting here on Rainbow Country with the fabulous Mark Tara.
So Raheem Thauer, let's get to know you on a deeper level, maybe a personal level.
Sure.
We've been talking about, you know, Canada's Queer and Trans Therapist Directory, mental mm-hmm. health. How did this all start for you? How did you end up getting into mental health originally?
Oh, well, I finished my Master's of Social Work at the University of Toronto in 2011. And right away, I was working at the AIDS Committee of Toronto and at a place called Hassle-Free Clinic. And my roles were in counseling. So I was doing bathhouse counseling, HIV STI testing. And my whole career has been focused on and attuned to the needs, concerns, experiences of LGBTQ people. I also, you know, spent about a decade doing LGBTQ Muslim community organizing with an organization called Salaam Canada, where we were talking about peer support, educational events, support systems for people who are reconciling faith and sexuality, or wanting safe spaces to explore what faith and how faith and sexuality coexist together. So everything about me is gay, and all of my work has been very gay. And this past June, I released a book called The Mental Health Guide for Cis and Trans Queer Guys. Easy to Google and find it.
The Politicized Practitioner.
So The Politicized Practitioner is like, it's my trademark title that I go by, and I do have a book series coming out under The Politicized Practitioner.
Okay.
But what came out this past June was by New Harbinger Publications, and it's actually like a self-help book that you pick up and you can work through various things that you're experiencing, like shame, the stress of coming out, connection to family of origin, grief around loss or things like masculinity, opportunities you never got, challenges with not fitting in, substance use, etc. So to answer your question, my whole life has been around, not my whole life, my whole professional life has been around queer and trans mental health. And as a queer person, I've also benefited, you know, from the services our community offers. And so that's where a lot of the inspiration comes for my work and for the things I create.
I always ask this of, you know, a doctor, or in this case, a therapist.
Yes.
So when a therapist needs therapy, who does the therapist turn to for therapy? Riddle me that.
Yes. You know, just another old therapist. No big deal.
But are you able to let yourself go without judging how someone is treating you?
Yes, and that is a hard thing to do. So
without judging it.
Yes, because I think we have our own defenses, right? And we're defensive around, like, can you help me? Can you not? Do you know as much as me? But I've had lots of therapy in my life, and I've gotten used to telling myself, like, I can intellectualize what's going on in my life, but I need to talk it through with somebody, and I need to feel safe enough to hear what they have to say. Somebody who's kind of a neutral party that I can hand myself over to be like, okay, what do you think?
2017.
Yes.
Any other way? How Toronto got queer. And you were just talking about this. 2025. From my research, it's called The Politicized Practitioner, The Essential Reader for Social Workers and Therapists. We were talking about you being you know, a social worker, being a therapist, you're also a writer.
Yes.
On those two books, you contributed to those as an editor, as a writer. How did you discover your talents for writing?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, it was, I knew that I always liked writing. And I know that because, like, I minored in English language and literature when I was in university. I used to like writing poetry as a younger person in high school. But more recently, and again, this really came to a head around in the early part of the pandemic, somebody reached out to me because I did a keynote presentation at Sex Down South, which is a conference in Atlanta. And they were like, your keynote was so great. I wonder if you'd want to turn it into like a 3-part essay. And so I did that, and it was received really well. And then I created an account on medium.com, and I started writing my own things. And it just feels so satisfying. It just felt so satisfying to be able to get my ideas out there without having to go through a publisher or doing it for somebody else's platform or another press. And so since then, since about maybe mid to late 2020, I've been putting out essays on medium.com. And it's been really lovely. And I'm just, people will tell me every now and then, oh, I read this thing you wrote on shame. I read this thing you wrote on envy. I read this thing you wrote on supporting or coming out to family members. And to me, that's just been so rewarding and satisfying. So I just keep doing it. I will say writing about topics from my expert lens is much easier than writing something that feels more personal. Mm. Like I wrote one essay on, or one piece on, bottoming and the anxiety about bottoming, the challenges, how to talk to partners. And I fumbled on it so hard because I was like, oh my gosh, I'm talking about myself in part of this. And it's a different kind of beast when you put yourself out there. So that can be harder.
So what was the hardest part about talking about bottoming?
Well, I think anything to do with self-disclosure, you think about like, what will it mean when this is out there?
Mm. Judging you.
Judging you, yeah. Mm. And it just, even if people aren't going to judge you, it feels a certain kind of way to say, I'm going to be vulnerable, right? It's a shift from, I'm an expert, I'm telling you some things that I've researched and that I've seen in our community versus, ugh. Here's where I come into it.
Here's I'm my a big story. Bottom.
Yeah.
I'm a submissive bottom. I'm an aggressive bottom. I'm a power bottom.
All of the things. Or like the thing I talked about in that particular thing in the beginning was like, I'm an anxious bottom. I've had an experience of assault. It's not a thing I want to try for a while. But here's the thing we need to talk about when we see ourselves through a one-dimensional lens. So that's how I started it. And I remember as soon as I hit publish, I cringed. I'm like, oh my, for the love of God, like, what are we doing here? It's fine. Of course it's fine. People who are interested will read it. People who are not won't. Like, who cares? Like, it's inconsequential, but it feels different is all I'm saying.
I love it. I love it. So when you are writing, more so from your own personal viewpoint, you find that more challenging. So do you tend to do that less often then?
Oh my gosh, yes. In fact, I was, you know, I've been working on this one book called Seeking for like 5 years, which is a collection of stories about navigating connection seeking as a queer guy, like wanting long-term connections, having long-term connections, but also wanting casual sex, negotiating non-monogamy, being somebody who, you know, liked to party a lot and what that meant for seeking, you know, when you're high at 4 a.m. and looking for whatever. And I was working with a writing coach and she was so great because I would talk the idea of each chapter through with her and she would say, this is so great. I love it. It's so funny. And I'm like, oh my God, is our hour over? Like, I can't do this anymore. I don't know how else to say it, except it feels harder. So it's, I like remove the pressure of the timeline. I'm like, that'll get done when it gets done. Honestly, it's just a different beast.
You know, it's funny because, on the radio show, I rarely give my own personal, like, you know, monologue or whatever. I just, like, you know, intro straight into the interview and end of the episode. So I totally understand where you're coming from in terms of, you know, expressing your own personal views. I mean, yes, of course, I chime in when a guest is talking about certain things, what have you, but I don't necessarily, you know, talk ad nauseum.
Right.
The political practitioner.
Yes.
This is what the title that you've given yourself?
Yes, the politicized practitioner, yes. And it's because I teach and I actually currently am living in Alabama. I teach at the University of Alabama on a contract. And it's been really important to, I think, acknowledge that we are all living in a world and in a time where our personal mental health is affected by the things that go on in the outside world. And for queer people, particularly trans people who are afraid of, you know, their rights being taken away, that anxiety comes to therapy. If there's, you know, war or conflict in another part of the world, that conversation comes to therapy, or it can. And so I think it's incredibly important to say, like, that's not going to be necessarily the whole focus of our therapy. But I want to acknowledge what you're bringing in, and your whole self includes the things that affect you in the world, which are political. Now, the concept of the politicized practitioner has also turned into a three-part book series that I co-edited. It's like a series of essays I've written, and other people in the field have responded and written their own pieces. And, you know, my publisher, Blue Cactus Press, they hadn't given me a page limit. And so I submitted something that was entirely too much. And so they came back and they're like, Raheem, we're going to have to release this in three parts. It's too many pages. And so the first part will come out in December. And that's really for social workers and therapists to think about things that regular school doesn't teach you, you know, like, what is it like to work with somebody who has experienced racism in a way that you haven't? What does it feel like? How do you think about supporting somebody who has significant body image issues? And you as a therapist are a very slim person, you know, like, what kind of envy gets projected onto you? How do you build trust when the client is thinking, oh, you don't know what the heck I experience out in the world? You know, and it's not just about positive thinking and well-being. It's like, does the therapist truly appreciate what other people are going through when they say they're struggling? And so this book really goes, well, this series now will delve into that. And so the first part comes out in December, which I'm super excited about.
So the politicized practitioner.
Yes.
The politicized practitioner. Are you then political?
Absolutely. Yes.
And how, and for yourself, taking out, you know, therapy, how are you political?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I think about, you know, being out and proud as a political statement. It's an emotional one. It's an interpersonal one. It's about acceptance, love, community, all those things. But in a world that would rather us be silent or be less visible, to me, that kind of visibility is political. You know, people, we all still get those questions. Why do you need a gay pride parade? Or why do you, does being gay need to be such a big part of your identity? And for me, I would say, well, it wouldn't have to be if it wasn't so contested. You know, if I didn't go into spaces wondering if I'm being looked at funny, or if I will fit in, or as a femme guy, if I will face ridicule or violence, you know, then it wouldn't be such a big part of my identity. But it's contested. And despite knowing that I could receive negative attention every day I wake up, you know, I put on what makes me feel great and I leave the house and I'm trying to be my best self in the world. And to me, that's a political statement in a world that really rewards sameness, conformity, hard work, keep your head down, try to fit into a mold that's been created by cis and straight people. So to me, that feels very political. Does that answer it for
you? Yeah. So you're currently based in Atlanta, did you say?
Close. I'm in Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
And you're in Alabama.
Born and raised Toronto.
Yeah, but you're in Alabama right now.
Yes.
And so how have, you're a Canadian.
Yes.
And you're in America. And you're also gay. You're a person of color. On and on and on and on. How yes. are you experiencing America currently?
It's challenging, I'm not gonna lie. I'm learning in public spaces or on platforms where people are asking me to speak, I had to be more conscientious about how I say and what I say. And that's new for me. You know, I haven't lived under that kind of surveillance before. However, this past summer I was traveling all around promoting my book, and I met so many lovely queer people around the country. And I was just also reminded of like the brilliance and resilience of queer people everywhere. And so that's been really lovely. You know, there's a difference between the anxiety we have about the state of the world, the impending, you know, executive orders or the way legislation and laws are going. And that's a real anxiety. Like, it has real consequences for people. But at the moment, I'm in a university town. My day-to-day is pretty good. My colleagues are really lovely and supportive. You know, I teach in a faculty of social work. So it's a particular kind of person that is a professor in social work. And my students have been really great. You know, I had some, some conservative backlash on campus about just me being me. And there were so many students who were right there supporting me. And so it's been a tough time, but also an eye-opening time. And there's been some beauty in just seeing how community comes together and how communities are there for each other in different places.
Alabama, that's considered the Deep South, isn't it?
Yes, ma'am.
And so being from Canada and you're now in the Deep South, are you seeing a racial aspect to life down there?
Yes. Things are wildly segregated.
How so? Give me an example.
Yeah. So just geographically, like where I live close to the university, it's predominantly white. And you know how people say, quote unquote, the other side of the tracks? Literally just west of me in West Tuscaloosa, there's a set of train tracks. And on the other side of those tracks is a poorer, mostly black community. And people regularly would tell me, you know, Raheem, the Tuscaloosa you experience is not Tuscaloosa. Like, that's the university bubble. And it's not like the two parts of town, there's like a good part and a bad part, or at least I don't see it that way. But there's like an architecture, you know, there's a remnant, a history of segregation, of slavery, of Jim Crow. And it's visible in that way. On the campus I work on, there's a building called the President's Mansion. It very much, you know, it used to be a plantation. And if I sent you a photo of it, or if you Google President's Mansion, UA, you would see it online. And there's a few homes that are like that across the town. And I did something here called the Hollow Grounds Tour that is like a special tour by a particular academic department. It's not super publicized, but they do it on request. And it takes you around and tells you the story of segregation, of lynching, of enslavement, of all kinds of things. And so there's a significant history here. You know, it was on the steps of one of our buildings on campus here where the governor, George Wallace, had said, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. And toward the end of his life, he changed his tune, but that's the ethos. That's the culture of where I am. And I'm on a campus where there's a number of student homes that have Trump flags. So I'm in a different place, you know, and I'm experiencing it. I'm taking it in. Having important conversations with future social workers in the classroom where I can. But it's been a learning curve for me, and it's challenging at times.
It's a different world than where you come from.
It's wow. So different. Yeah.
Raheem, really powerful is. Words, powerful words. Here's my last question for you. And it's simply this: Canada's Queer and Trans Therapist Directory. What would you like your long range hope for this directory to be?
I would love it for people to have a central place to to get care that they want without having to wait more than a week or two. You know, I've worked in public service for a long time and the wait lists are very long. And I do think mental health is health and it should be free for everyone, but that's not where we're at, you know? And so for people who have benefits through employment and they want to see somebody quicker, it would be great if they could use a directory like this. I also want to make sure, and I've included this, there's a resource section where you can look for free services and publicly funded services in all provinces. So I would want to continue to beef that up. I really want to create something that works in a way that supplements and supports and props up the public system, but also streamlines people so that if they have the means and the resources, they can get care. And, you know, recently I've had a few people say, oh, I'm in a private practice clinic and I have a student working under me. Can they be on the directory? And I was like, yes, they can be on the directory free of charge and make sure they charge, you know, their clients a sliding scale, like a lower fee rate, and let's get it moving. So I really, my whole thing is about creating accessibility and getting people culturally competent care. You know, you don't want a therapist where you have to explain coming out, or they're always talking about being queer when you're talking about, you know, navigating polyamory or whether or not you want to keep using poppers or whatever it is. You know, like you want someone who gets the things about your life experience. And that, I think, is my goal, to make that as widespread and accessible as possible.
Well said, well said, Raheem Fowler. Well said, well done, well curated. Thanks for your time. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
For more on Canada's Queer and Trans Therapist Directory, simply visit queertranstherapists.com. And to keep up to date with today's guest, Raheem Fowler, you can find him at thepoliticizedpractitioner.com.
Magnus Hirschfeld made the modern homosexual. He co-founded the world's first gay rights group, the Scientific Humanitarian Committee, in Berlin in 1897. But what is far more important is that he and his colleagues came up with an enormously influential concept of what same-sex desire was, what it meant, and how it fit into the wider world. If you think homosexuality is an inborn quality that cannot be changed and has a biological root, but is not an illness, and if you think gay people are a sexual minority who are born that way and who deserve legal protections just as racial minorities do, you owe those ideas to Hirschfeld and a handful of others. He was among the first to articulate that conceptual model of what it means to be gay in print in 1896.
We just heard professor, author, and historian of queer and trans politics, Lori Marhoefer, reading from Racism and the Making of Gay Rights, a sexologist, his student, and the Empire of Queer Love, their powerful new gay history book, about the man who made the modern homosexual, a German physician and sexologist who died at the age of 67 in 1935, Magnus Hirschfeld.
Hi, I'm Justin Ling, author of Missing from the Village. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country, Malcolm McLaren, Deep in Vogue.
take it out on the dance floor.
What your local wetland has done for you lately? Wetlands function like nature's kidneys, mitigating the impacts of floods and droughts, protecting our communities, and supporting food production. Despite representing 6% of the Earth's surface, wetlands store 33% of the planet's carbon. If you value life, thank a wetland. Learn about wetlands at work with Ducks Unlimited Canada at ducks.ca/wetlands.
Sick and tired of feeling sick and tired? Don't know where to go for help? We know how that feels, and we found help in Narcotics Anonymous. We have 7 days a week in Kingston. We do recover. You get more information on our website at www.limestonena.com or our Facebook page, Limestone Area of Narcotics Anonymous, or call the regional hotline 888-811-3887 for more information or to find a meeting.